Welcome to The Forum, the Columbus Metro Club's weekly program that cultivates the conversations that drive Columbus forward. The Forum is where Columbus comes to talk. Every Wednesday, The Forum brings together visionary leaders to examine issues that matter, exchange diverse perspectives, and forge connections that create a better Columbus. We'd love to have you join us. Tickets and information about upcoming forums are available at columbusmetroclub.org. This week, we welcomed leaders who are reimagining how Central Ohio communities can better respond to help people in crisis. New innovations include the statewide rollout of the 988 Crisis Hotline, a new non-police response program set for a 2026 ballot, and the opening of the Franklin County Crisis Care Center this year. These efforts mark a shift away from relying on police for mental health and substance use emergencies, offering new strategies and services that save lives and reduce risk for both citizens and first responders. This week's panelists are Columbus City Council member Melissa Green, Erica Clark Jones, CEO of the Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board of Franklin County, Dr. Brian Stroh, CEO and Medical Director of NetCare, and Chana Wiley, co-chair of the Columbus Safety Collective Campaign. Our host is Samantha Hendrickson, medical business and healthcare reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Let's join this week's Columbus Metropolitan Club Forum, Transforming Crisis Care in Central Ohio.
All right, let's get started setting a bit of a foundation for our conversation. So let's define crisis care and what a crisis care response looks like as opposed to a traditional law enforcement or other emergency response to a crisis.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for the question. It's an honor to be on this panel and to be in the room with so many colleagues and partners that have really made our reinvention of our local crisis system possible. So for us, a behavioral health crisis, when an individual has one that's either related to mental health or substance use disorder, we want there to be resources, either someone to call, someone to come, or somewhere safe to go in this event. And so if you had a crisis in Central Ohio 15 years ago, it's going to look really different on the last day here in 2025 here in Columbus, Ohio, and Franklin County. 988 is what we recommend as the first number to call when you are in crisis, and it is not a safety-related issue. We want you to call 988. We know, I know you'll hear more here, but several calls are de-escalated right there on the call. There are professionals on the 988 line that can de-escalate a situation or triage a situation and determine if someone needs to respond. For us, someone to respond is our mobile crisis teams, which our community has several of. These are individuals that are clinicians, trained professionals, sometimes even with a peer, and sometimes they join law enforcement to go out and meet the person where they are, in the community, in their community-based setting, hoping to be able to address the challenge right on site. But if that cannot be done, we want there to be a safe place to go. Now, we know our hospitals have stood in the gap for so long. And as Susan mentioned in the opening, in 2014, we had so many individuals that were in psychiatric crisis filling our emergency departments inappropriately, frankly. We didn't have enough room to accommodate them. We weren't treating them in the best possible setting. And so the recommendations from that plan going to the foundations was to make sure we build out our capacity in the community to be able to treat these crises. And so a community-based crisis facility to be able to be a safe place where people can go, we think is a great addition to our community. So for us, it's not about one form of crisis care. It's the entire continuum of crisis care that supports individuals who are in mental health or psychiatric or substance use disorder distress.
Let's, if it's okay, kind of go down the line. I want to talk about the different parts. You guys are all, you know, very much in that continuum of care, but I want to talk about each of your individual roles in this crisis care community that we're building here in Columbus, Ohio, and what your individual responses look like.
We are an unusual community behavioral health center. We most provide outpatient services and do it well. We were conceived differently, or we were reorganized differently, I should say, about 20 years into our existence, and we focus mostly on crisis. So we do lots of things that maybe you're familiar with or maybe you're not, and frankly, that you might not be aware of them is partially by design, but it's also worth talking about. So we do some community mobile, we run the community mobile team, which is a 24/7 team of a clinician and a peer who go out to folks who are willing to have us while they're in crisis. Most of those calls are coming from our legacy phone line and from 988. We do both of those as well, so that's another line of service for us. You may have seen our vans driving around town that are marked NetCare. Those are the row vans. We pick up people who are publicly intoxicated and take them to a place of safety so that we can get them engaged in treatment. We've been doing that for decades. We also run probate pre-screening services. So one of the features that we're gonna talk today is that in crisis, we define it by how the person in crisis defines it, which is a really central tenet. But the flip side of that is that people who are severely mentally ill have what we call a lack of insight. They don't understand they're ill, and frankly, often they don't understand they're in crisis. And that's our job to step up to the plate and say, hey, you need some help, and the probate process is part of what does that. We run several other programs as well, but in the interest of time, I'll pass it along.
Hi, everyone. I'm Chana Wiley, again, with Columbus Safety Collective Campaign. And we are running a campaign to put an issue on the ballot in May of 2026 for a non-police response system to mental health, behavioral health, our houseless community, the substance abuse community. And we are trying to complement these services that already exist. There are over 100 calls a day that come into the 911 center for behavioral and mental health calls, and we can't respond appropriately to all of these calls currently. So what Columbus wants to do, the residents have said that they want this program around 80% through our polling. I've been working the last 5 years with the collective and also this last year with the campaign. So we want to reimagine public safety and get people the correct response and complement existing programs to streamline everything. So we know that that person on the line, whether they call 988 or 911, they're getting the correct response. I'm collecting signatures now, and I've heard hundreds of stories, and they do break my heart. You know, lost my brother in 2017 in a mental health crisis, and he is the catalyst for this campaign. He was beaten to death by Columbus Police Department. So I want to make sure that does not continue to happen as it has continued to happen.
So at the City of Columbus, we are both a provider of alternate crisis services as well as a funder of alt crisis services, as well as a convener and coordinator of the development and build out of this system. As we are trying to bring the foundational pieces that we've been working on over the last decade together and scale them to be able to meet the community need here locally. We know that a large portion of our county's population lives within the City of Columbus, so we take that responsibility to be a leader at that table very seriously, but we also know that crisis doesn't stop at the city line too, you know, and that's why it's so beneficial to be able to work closely with our partners like the Adam Board and our other partners across the system to make sure that we are thinking about this in a regional way. We have had, you know, some of our earliest iterations of our alternate crisis programs, you know, I think really started getting up and running around that kind of the beginning of this last wave of the opiate crisis, right? So we've got a lot of folks in the room understand and know about our REACT program that goes out and responds to individuals and their families that have experienced a drug overdose to try to connect them and link them with services and prevent future overdoses and promote well-being among that population. You know, we also have been engaged with our more recently our Right Response Unit, which is embedding social workers and clinicians into our 911 call center. So of course now we're looking at this integration as 988 is coming online and moving nationwide, and how do we integrate that into our systems of care? We also know last year I think we had about 21,000 mental health related calls just come through in our 911 call center. And so figuring out, you know, everyone knows that number, 911. So while they're on the phone and we have them, let's not make them hang up and call someone else. Let's be able to get them right there and then to someone that can support them. And those are clinical services, much like the 988 response. Who here has done telehealth before, right? Like I see my therapist in telehealth every other week. And, you know, we're providing a mental health intervention on that phone. It's not just someone sitting in a call center answering answering in another place, providing local access and connection to resources there, and then are also able to dispatch our mobile crisis response unit, our MCR unit, from there as well, or connect and link to other teams. We have also had incredible amount of success through our SPARK program, which is a program that follows up on EMS runs. We estimate that that program diverts and prevents up to 15,000 EMS runs a year by being able to prevent a crisis through those follow-ups. And so we know that those holistic interventions work, and we're working to figure out how can we build out what we have and continue to go further to meet more people where they're at and support more people in our community.
Samantha, I just wanted to make sure everyone understands the role of the Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board. We, by Ohio Revised Code, are responsible for the planning, the funding, and the evaluation of community behavioral health services across our county. There are 49 other boards like ours across the state of Ohio. We have a very strong relationship with OMAS, and so we weigh in on policy. But when it comes to crisis, 31% of Adam H.'s budget goes to crisis. And by the way, our largest source of revenue is a property tax levy for homeowners in Franklin County. The last time folks voted for it here in Central Ohio was 2020, and we're back on the ballot this fall. So roughly $30 million goes to support the efforts that at NetCare, Mary Haven, RI, and the Franklin County Community, Franklin County Crisis Care Center, and several other community-based providers. We have relationships with over 50 different nonprofit providers here providing behavioral health in our community. And as Councilmember Green mentioned, we are a convener of tables. That is what we do. We do it for crisis, we do it for treatment, for recovery, for prevention, family supports, and housing alongside our partners at the Community Shelter Board. So we are embedded within the system, and we use our resources responsibly to make sure there's a behavioral health safety net for our county.
Great. Thank you, guys. Perfect foundation to give us what we need, and thank you for giving some numbers as well. I'm curious, you know, this is a lot of progress in just a few short years. What really kicked off this, of, you know, what did you guys see of, oh, Columbus needs this? This is something that's going to benefit this community. What were you seeing in the community that told you that this was a need?
I'll start, but then I'll kick it over very quickly. I think, first of all, I'm really glad that you say it seemed like it happened in a really short amount of time, because I think the partners in the room would say this is an 11-year journey at a minimum. That doesn't...
Small eternity,
right. I think the conversation was happening informally well before 2014. In 2014, the Columbus Foundation, Osteopathic Heritage Foundation, Central Ohio Trauma System, our hospitals all came together and said, this cannot continue. And so the first thing they said was, let's build a system of partnership and agree that we all have a responsibility to change how individuals experience crisis in our city and build out a whole system, not disparate parts. So I think in the last 5 years, though, you've seen a lot of momentum. And kudos to the state of Ohio and the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. I mean, they supported 988 for the state of Ohio. They pushed it out to all of the counties. And Franklin County, the minute we heard about it, we said, yes, please. We signed up. We support 988. As a matter of fact, we supplement 988 every year with about $1.1 million to make sure no call is dropped. Every call is answered and connected to services. So I appreciate that. But it was in response to, and Dr. Stroh, I know NetCare was at the table. It was in response to emergency departments having long boarding times for individuals in psychiatric distress at a minimum. But please elaborate.
Sure. Erica and every board in the state is responsible for providing crisis services. And counties do that different ways. Some counties say, we're going to subsidize emergency departments to handle this for us. Franklin took a different approach in the mid-90s and said, we're going to build a crisis center, and that was NetCare. We, by the time we got to this conversation, were at the place where we had folks sleeping on floors. We had kids commingled with adults because we didn't have the room to separate them. We were way beyond capacity, and the ERs were right there along with us. That, timed with the opioid epidemic, which quickly became a fentanyl epidemic, and Medicaid expansion, changed this whole game, for the better in what I said is a short eternity, but is actually kind of the blink of an eye. And so we are finally at, or coming up on anyway, there is no wrong door. You can get a hold of this system any which way, exactly the way we do in the rest of healthcare. One of the criticisms of behavioral health is that it lives differently than the rest of the healthcare system does. Part of that is out of necessity, and part of that is a barrier that we're working to break down.
For me, I think it started when I lost my brother, honestly, because that's when I was activated and started my advocacy. So it started then, but I can agree with the two of you that it started a long time ago when Columbus saw the need for the change. And what we want to do with the campaign, like I said earlier, is just complement existing programs and scale them up and have all those services integrated so there's no wrong door approach. And so when someone calls 911 or 988, they are going to get a continued response that is going to help them in a safe manner and bring them to care, even if they don't need to be brought in, but they're de-escalated over the phone, or we just meet them in their communities. So this campaign will definitely give the residents of Columbus what they've been asking for a long time, is a non-police response system to these mental health calls, and also that sometimes they're afraid when they see officers, and sometimes like officers just aren't trained appropriately, and we appreciate our officers for what they do and all the hard work that they do, but we would like medical professionals, peer supporters that are trained to respond to these calls.
If I can add to that for just a second, it is vitally important to remember, and I think most people in this room know this, but if you don't, there is a perception in the media that mentally ill people or substance using folks are inherently dangerous. The statistics show over and over and over again that people with behavioral health concerns are much more likely to be victimized rather than do the victimizing. So that is a consideration here. When we built the system, we said, look, you know, we're not trying to criminalize people's health problems. We don't want that. And that's part of how we got here today as well.
I would like to add that in this no wrong door approach that you mentioned, and Chandra, you mentioned, for us, it's anyone can seek behavioral health support regardless of their ability to pay. That's what we're able to do as a community-based behavioral health care system. So whether you are insured, underinsured, or have no insurance at all, we're going to make sure providers in our network are able to see you.
That kind of slides into my next question of, you know, with law enforcement having historically been the first responders to people in these kinds of crises, you know, what were prior to these implementations or even continue to be consequences of that system that's been held on to, whether it be for families, for police themselves, and people actively in crisis?
I mean, I think that's its own CMC forum trying to unpack some of that. I think, you know, you obviously have, of course, like a sense of community mistrust that needs to be earned back over time and consistency and continued demonstration of change in policy and values, reaffirmation of values over and over and over again, the same as in any other type of relationship in any of our lives. I think that, you know, thinking about the impact on the system itself, right? Figuring out how we can appropriately adjust course to make sure that people are getting the right interventions, right? And I'm a social worker, a very proud licensed social worker. And we talk a lot in that field about scope of practice, right? Making sure that you're working within your scope of practice. And so for a long time, we had, you know, I think the majority of folks, very dedicated public service servants that were working outside of their scope of practice. So as we continue to right size that, as we continue to invest in the development of a new system that's able to scale and grow and innovate and meet the needs and expectations of our community, you know, we can figure out how we can readjust resources so that we're appropriately investing in the right types of interventions and the right types of work.
In an interesting take, you know, I've spent my entire career in behavioral health crisis, and when we're talking about reallocating system resources, it is actually very reassuring that no one's being territorial because it's a power grab or because whatnot. We are so dedicated to the work that it feels strange to let go, and so we are getting there. But like most people who are truly dedicated, you have to let go, knowing that someone's going to catch. And catch well. And that the trust factor that we're talking about, it's not that we distrust our partners, we're just getting to know each other in a system that is part and parcel different than it was 10 years ago.
And when you speak of the trust factor, one thing that our campaign wants to do and that our community crisis amendment wants to do is build trust in our communities, that when you call and you call for help, you're confident in knowing that you will not get harmed and you will get the right response that you need. And community trust is very important.
And Shauna, as a community organizer, I want to specifically ask you, you know, have you seen a change since these things have been more implemented in the community when it comes to that trust, or what work and accountability is still needed?
I have seen a change, you know, with 988 rolling out, you know, people are happy, they're confident that they're going to get the correct response. It's just that when you're in a crisis, sometimes people don't remember to call 988. They kind of revert back to 911 because we've been using it for so long. And, you know, sometimes it's just, it's new, we're working on it, and we just don't always get the right response. I was collecting signatures, and a few people were just so excited to sign. They had someone, a case manager at this building had called for help for a lady. She was just released from a psychiatric hospital maybe 4 days prior, and she had went in herself to get help, was released, and was cutting herself. It took the case manager an hour to find who they needed to call. That's way too long. The lady could have literally bled out, but it took her an hour because she called NetCare, she called 988, and then she called 911. But the case manager didn't want to call 911 initially because she was fearful of the outcome. But then she said, I should have just called 911. Maybe they would have came sooner, because there were just different fragmentations and faults in calling originally. So we just want to get that cleaned up, and we want to help people get a quick, correct response.
And speaking of new, I think in the last 30 days, actually it's probably not even a week old, but 988 and 911 have come to an agreement on their protocols and procedures, and now there will be a partnership where 911 can transfer calls to 988 so that we can get the appropriate response. So thank you for bringing that up. I think it illuminating that situation, us listening to that, and all of our partners. And I'll just say something about trust, by the way. We also had to build trust among our partners. It's not just, I mean, it is the trust with the community and our providers, but it's our providers with our other partners. Law enforcement, our emergency medical technicians, they have to trust when they're coming to a community-based facility, the individuals are going to get the care that they need as well. And so we've been learning how to work together, work cooperatively, plan together, and keep each other accountable.
To the point that we've got all these this service array, one of the interesting things that we're running into, and I think we all became, whether we meant to or not, got a lot more comfortable with telehealth about 5 years ago now. 988 is interesting in that it will stay on the line as long as makes sense. So if I can de-escalate, we can just de-escalate somebody, and that takes 75 minutes, it takes 75 minutes. The interesting thing is, from our, again, 988 is a consortium of providers. There's a common number you dial, and then a big computer in the sky redirects the call to call centers, right? For our call center, 93% do not require an in-person touch at the end of that call, but that's because we can talk as long as we need to, okay? So think of it kind of as on-demand telehealth that is not going through your insurance, and then you get a better picture of why that service makes so much sense. Not that people don't need in-person responses sometimes. 7% absolutely do, and that's why we want to make sure that we use the rest of our armamentarium well. Is this something that a civilian team can respond to, yes or no? Is this something that, as if on cue, is this something that requires a first responder, yes or no? Is this something that requires a probate team, yes or no? We can stratify that last 7% much more precisely when we're given the time to work through people's issues rather than say, I really need to take that next call.
So I want to talk about diversity and equity in crisis care. Recently, the Trump administration ended the 988 Lifeline's special service for LGBTQ young people. What impact have you seen from this decision so far across crisis care response? And are you preparing for any similar moves for other identity groups? And how can we ensure we are addressing the diverse needs of a population in crisis care? That was a lot.
I can start with that one. I will tell you, I lead from the lens of being a gay man, that at the end of the day, I absolutely wish option 3 were still there. I will also tell you that I think that the rest of the options in the call tree are equally able to take care of my community. We train folks to take every eventuality. I could show you a litany of trainings that our 988 staff do that cover lots and lots and lots of bases. I am less interested in which numbers are out there to push than when you talk to somebody, they're able to help that person. Part of me really does want that option back, and part of me thinks it's a distraction. Let's do our job and do it well.
The other thought is, I hope no other group will be eliminated from services or targeted for any means. Here locally, though, no one will be turned away for service, regardless where they live, what their background is. That's not what we do here in Franklin County.
To continue on the equity line of questions, historically Black and brown communities, people in poverty, and families touched by addiction have had the most fraught relationships in a crisis response. How are the new approaches addressing those issues? We talked about trust in the community, but issues of equity that unfortunately have been a part of our system for a long time.
We did crisis for the better part of 30 years. And when we looked at our data for decades, over and over and over again, we were disproportionately serving Black men. And there's a reason for that. There were no ongoing services or not enough ongoing services that reached that way. And that's not a fault of Adam or anyone else. It was that community wasn't as engaged by the system as it probably should have been. We pivoted to some outpatient care, and one of the things that we told SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, when we got a grant to stand that up, was our target, one of our targets was, we know we've been serving this population for decades for lack of ongoing treatment options. So the flip side, and I think Erica would agree, but I'll let her speak to this, is you can build a crisis system. You also have to build a treatment system that is set up to not let people either linger or live in crisis. It's both. So when a crisis, just like in an ER, an emergency department is necessarily dependent on other medical services to get people well and keep them well with the fallback for when that happens. But it really is two sides of the same coin.
Just to support that, we spend, like I mentioned earlier, 31% of our budget is for crisis, 36% is for treatment. So we recognize it takes an entire community to do wraparound and follow-up services to keep individuals from going into crisis in the first place. And done well, we know that we can prevent 85% from coming back.
At the city, you know, health equity is built into everything that we're doing. It's built into our interventions, things like the CARE Coalition, through Columbus Public Health, through our initiatives and the changes in policy that we've implemented, changes in training that we've implemented through the Columbus Division of Police and across our public safety department. It's built into the way that we staff and position our programs in the community to make sure that we're addressing health inequities and that we're available in communities that have been disproportionately impacted by whatever issue it is that we're there to combat, and it's something that we're thinking about every day and have to continue thinking about more than ever in this current political climate that we're existing in right now.
You are listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. Today we're exploring how Central Ohio is reshaping crisis care, from hotline access to community-based responses. Our guests this week are sharing how new approaches are saving lives and changing outcomes. This week's panelists are Columbus City Councilmember Melissa Green, Erica Clark-Jones, CEO of the Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board of Franklin County, Dr. Brian Stroh, CEO and Medical Director of NetCare, and Chana Wiley, co-chair of the Columbus Safety Collective Campaign. Our host is Samantha Hendrickson, medical business and healthcare reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. We'll return to this week's CMC Forum, Transforming Crisis Care in Central Ohio, after a short break.
Hi, I'm Raghav Raj. I'm the student intern here at 90.5 WCBE. Did you know that you can tune into this show on WCBE's new app? Whether you're on the go or staying home, the WCBE app lets you listen to our programming online, anytime. For local music, community news, and original podcasts, find WCBE on the App Store or the Google Play Store today.
Hi there, this is Morgan James. Every album represents a step in an artist's journey. Hello, music lovers. I'm inviting you to listen to Music Journeys with Mike Foley. Mike mixes music and conversation with artists to share what informed and inspired their latest project, how the love of music began, what music means to them, and so much more. We've chatted about three of my projects, the most recent being Soul Remains the Same, a soul album of songs you would never expect. You can always expect the perfect combination of music and stories on Music Journeys. The show airs Saturday afternoons at 3:30 on WCBE. Recent episodes are available on the major podcast platforms and the WCBE app. To meet and hear more from all the musicians featured since its start in 2018, including me, to be the first to be featured three times on the show, look for Music Journeys on WCBE's podcast experience at WCBE.org.
Welcome back to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. Central Ohio is building a new model of crisis response. From innovative care centers to community campaigns, our guests this week explain what's working and what's still needed to keep citizens and first responders safe. This week's panelists are Columbus City Council member Melissa Green, Erica Clark-Jones, CEO of the Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board of Franklin County, Dr. Brian Stroh, CEO and Medical Director of NetCare, and Chana Wiley, co-chair of the Columbus Safety Collective campaign. Our host is Samantha Hendrickson, medical business and healthcare reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Let's get back to this week's CMC Forum, Transforming Crisis Care in Central Ohio.
Well, I have a lot more questions on this list that I wish I could ask you because this has been a great panel so far. So thank you guys so much. It is CMC's longstanding tradition to take audience questions. We'll move to questions from our live stream and in-person audiences in just a few minutes. If you have a question, please make your way over to the microphone in the back of the room. You can see Doug waving over there. If you're joining us online, you can please type your questions into the chat before we take audience questions. I have one more question for you guys. If we succeed in building the system that all of you envision, what does Central Ohio look like 10 years from now when someone has a mental health or addiction crisis?
Okay, what I envision in the next 10 years, if we all succeed at what we want to do, is Columbus looking like half of other cities in the world that have alternate crisis response programs. We just get a safer response. We have healthier communities. We have more trust in our communities. And we have systems that are set up to see us succeed all the way around. Thank you.
Now I'm going to try Hermite. Oh, it works. See? I would second that. In medicine, we spend a lot of time. No, it's bad. In medicine, we spend a lot of time talking about this phrase, level of care, right? And if done well, systems are built out where it accommodates pretty much every level of care. And that should be everything from, I can walk into a center, I can pick up a phone. I'm a young kid, I text. I don't talk, I text. So good, well, let's do text. We should be able to get you into a hospital when you need to, and you should be able to get out of the hospital with resources that make sure that you stay out of the hospital. So we are a heck of a long way from where we were 10 or 15 years ago. There's room for improvement in every single sphere of everybody's lives. So we're working toward that, but we're getting there.
We're going to go down the line. I love everything that both of them shared, and I know we all agree to that. The challenge, and I hate to bring us down, but as a community payer, the challenge is sustainability. I think if we demonstrate proof of concept that people are better and our city is healthier as a result of us having unfettered, equitable access to behavioral health care, if we can use Columbus, Franklin County, as a demonstration project to prove additional funding, dedicated funding, should be given to communities to support fully build out crisis continuums, we will be better off. And that, I think, is the next best step. And I know we have partners at Ohio Mental Health and Addiction Services helping to work to make this happen.
That's along the same lines of what I was gonna talk about here. I think that what we have here is it's a resource issue, right? When you imagine that, we're really only scratching the surface of, I think, of what the need is and what the potential could be for us to provide these services. Right now, Adam Board's only funding you know, you're funding a lot of the clinical side of that work. We're doing some of the stuff in the that's more integrated into 911 and our emergency response systems. And, you know, you're spending $31 million a year. If we think about the fact that right now we have 1,800 police officers that are employed at the Columbus Division of Police, if we think maybe 25% of those calls could be diverted into an alternate crisis response program, that's 450 clinicians. If you do the math on that in our budget, that's probably somewhere between 50 and 85. $5 million a year, which is a whole another levy. That's how much, about how much money our Adam Board revenue generates through their levy right now. And when you think about workforce issues, you know, Central Ohio, the state of Ohio, the United States of America is in the midst of a very well-documented behavioral health workforce shortage crisis right now. So even if we had on the top end $85 million to be able to fund this big and important work, we're not going to find 450 clinicians without strategic integration into our current existing continuums of care. And that's something that we've done really, really well here in Columbus and Franklin County for a long time. There have been barriers that recently have started coming down through innovative practices and data sharing and electronic medical record keeping and changes in policies and restrictions that sometimes I think would have been prohibitive. But now we're moving into what is well accepted as the systems of care approach as a best practice, both in relation to the work that we do in crisis services, but across the board in healthcare, right? You have a chest pain, you can walk into any doctor's office, you're gonna pretty much have the same experience, right? You're gonna get an EKG, they're gonna send you to an emergency room, you're gonna be evaluated, you're gonna you know, be on medication, you might have surgery, you're gonna have medication for the rest of your life, you're gonna have receive follow-up and checkups from that one crisis situation. And we think there should be parity, there should be equity in the way that our behavioral health system as a whole is working. We couldn't hire those 450 clinicians without creating massive infrastructure challenges in the other parts of our continuum of care. And as we've learned over many years, crisis response is actually one of the most expensive types of response. So if we rob the system of its resources, both financially and from a workforce perspective in other areas, we only create other problems in other areas. So we have to be thinking about how do we build a workforce here in Central Ohio? How do we fund a comprehensive program that's able to do what we know it's capable to do if it's properly resourced? And how do we mobilize and integrate into our existing systems of care so that we can make sure that people have access to the full range of services that everyone needs throughout their lifespan, that we're not just focusing so much solely on building out one crisis program, that it has a detrimental impact on the rest of our continuum of care.
Thank you guys again so, so much. Now, Doug is curating some questions from our live stream audience. For those of you here with us in person, that microphone line is looking pretty short, if you don't mind. But our panelists have also done a really excellent job of, I think, covering everything, so I understand. But Doug?
Samantha, thank you very much. Thank you so much to today's panelists for a great and an important and critical conversation. Thank you all. If you do have a question for today's panelists, please do join me here at the microphone, as this gentleman just has. If you're watching online, please type your question in the chat. It'll get texted to me. We'll try to get to as many of those as we can. I'm going to launch us off with this one. Can you speak a little bit more about how these particular crisis care resources are being funded? And are the federal grant and spending cuts likely to impact crisis care in Central Ohio? I might add, will the changes to Medicaid also impact crisis care in Central Ohio?
I'll start us off. Yes. however, this underscores the importance. So yes, any changes to Medicaid have a ripple effect throughout our entire community, not even just behavioral health care, but even physical health care as well. For us, this is the reason why local dollars are so important. The state of Ohio does indeed give Adam H. Board's dollars to pass through our community-based providers. And we do receive some pass-through from the feds for crisis here in our community. But the lion's share of that expense is through our local property tax levy. And so Adam H., we feel now, and we, while we are a minority payer, there are obviously managed care plans that support the care, an individual's care if they have that, but Adam H. is that safety net. We make sure that these services are available in our community. So this is why it's important to support the local levy, because it keeps these systems supported. I'll stop.
I'll treat you.
the word parity got mentioned earlier, and what a lot of folks don't know about behavioral health financing is it's really, as I mentioned, the system's wildly different about how we provide care. The system about how we pay for it is also wildly different. Boards exist because we deinstitutionalized patients in the 60s, appropriately. We said we're gonna spend money not hospitalizing people, we're gonna put that money into community resources. No other medical problem has a parallel system of care the way we do. So that parallel system to the outsider, you know, you look and say, why are you so much different? Because this has been entrenched for 65 years. Crisis, interestingly, is not paid for by most private insurers. It is not paid for by Medicaid and Medicare. Well, that depends. So it does right now rely on boards. The irony of this is if I have a psychiatric crisis and I need that level of crisis services, that's not covered. If my same organ malfunctions and I have a stroke, fully covered. EMS gets covered, your ED gets covered, your surgery gets covered, your medicines get covered, no question. So we still have this divide up between the psychiatric side of the brain and the neurologic side of the brain, and the funding models go with that, and it's high time we talk about that too.
Yeah, if I might, I just, yes to all of that. Well, first and foremost, I want to give the Adam Board credit, flowers that I think you deserve, because 31% of their budget right now is going to crisis services. That's a whole new side of continuum of care that did not exist before. And so the ability for them to be able to maneuver in their budget to be able to make that work and do it, you know, without any support, or, you know, just to step up and say, I know this is the right thing to do, and we're going to do it, and we're going to figure out how to make it happen, that I think is commendable. So if we can give them a round of applause. And then the next thing that I really feel like is important to say in this moment is related to that equity and that pay equity. And I'm going to say something that I don't think a lot of elected officials feel, but I believe that's really important for us to speak truth to power in this moment and to talk about the inequity in the way that we have funded our human services programs and our social safety nets for as long as they have existed, ever since the Great New Deal. And I'll use a little bit of an example. You know, at the city, when we have a need to build a bridge, we ask the experts to tell us how to build a bridge. They tell us how to build the bridge. Then we ask architects and engineers and construction experts, how much does it cost to build that bridge? They tell us how much it costs. We pay them the amount of money that it costs to do that big and important work. They build us a wonderful bridge. In fact, we actually make sure that they don't eat a loss if the project actually runs over. And they build us a bridge, and we've got a great structurally sound bridge to be able to drive on for generations. But as it relates to the way that historically at every level of funding, for the funders in the room, myself included, that we have funded our human infrastructure, when we have a need to build a bridge for people out of poverty, when we have a need to build a bridge for people out of crisis, we often don't let the architects and the engineers and the experts design that bridge and tell us how it needs to be built. We often sort of have an idea for a pilot project, which if I never hear the words pilot project again, it will still be too soon. But we dictate the terms of that arrangement. We ask people to tell us how much money it costs to do that big and important work. They tell us how much money it costs to do that big and important work, and we say, great, we'll give you 25% of that, and you got to fundraise the rest. And so this is a problem that has existed forever, and it's one that I think is important to talk about in order for us to imagine a new way forward, right? And we, at a time that we find ourselves in right now, with the state and the federal budget cuts that we know are coming, that we know are going to affect our continuums of care the most and the most vulnerable people in the community the most and the people that care for those people the most, we're going to have less resources than we've had before, but we also still can't not talk about that very real problem that exists, because then if we don't acknowledge it, we're never able to move forward. We're never able to imagine a world where a social worker, a case manager, makes a living wage that's commensurate with the talent and the time and the dedication that it takes to do that big and important work to get a family from living in a shelter system to living in a permanent home and thriving in a local environment. That is hard work, and it is heart work. It deserves to be paid appropriately. It deserves to be funded fully. And we have to start thinking about that, because that's the future that I imagine when I think about our crisis continuum. It's not, it's about addressing the crisis, but it's about building a system that's sustainable, both for the people that are funding it, both for the people that are entering it and utilization and utilizing it, as well as for the people that are existing in it and doing the that work day in and day out.
Thank you. Have another question?
I had the privilege of being able to be at the ribbon cutting for the Crisis Center and see inside the space, and I want to brag on you all a little bit and what you've done there, and wondering, Erica, if you could talk a little bit about all the things that happen once a person arrives at the care center, but then the whole host of services as they consider leaving and going back to their family and the community.
I also had the privilege of touring it, and if you don't mind also touching on the really intentional architecture of the space and the physical functional journey that you go through the building, I think that's a really cool thing to share. It's just a very tangible thing that people can see as a holistic approach.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for the question. And already, I'm going to say we have an expert resource in our staff. He's in the back of the room. So if you want to know more, Jonathan Thomas is available to give you more details on this project. But thank you for the question, Susan, and thank you for the support of the Osteopathic Heritage Foundation. Dr. Stroh made a point, and I want to make sure I illuminate it. We have had community-based crisis center in our community for decades. What we have now, and I am thrilled to say, within the next 20 days, will be open on the west side, will be additional community-based capacity. No wrong door, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There is a dedicated entrance for first responders, law enforcement officers, and mobile crisis response teams, so that they never have to wait and they do not get turned away. This journey, the Franklin County Crisis Center, again, many years in the making, is a person, it is an environment where the individual and their needs is put first. It is person-centered care. It looks different, it feels different, it is different. It is a home-like setting for individuals to be there for short crisis days. So we have 60 medical recliners for individuals that are going to be monitored for 23 hours or less, right? To be able to interact with a professional, understand what is happening, de-escalate the situation, determine diagnosis, and determine what is the next most appropriate level of care. When fully operational, not only will we have the crisis observation units, 60 recliners, we'll also have a behavioral health urgent care right there, again, available to anyone. And it has light medical care, thanks to our partners at the OSU Wexner Medical Center, who are our partners here in this facility. So that light medical issues that are happening at the same time an individual presents with a psychiatric crisis or a substance use disorder emergency don't get turned away. They don't say, hey, you have this, you have to go to an emergency room. No, we wanted to treat that there. Additionally, when fully operational, we will have inpatient beds on the second level, just in case we need longer observation or there's no space within our community to be able to see people. As far as architects and the architecture and that journey, we did design the building with the patient's journey in mind. Never did we want someone to have to go back into an environment. We wanted them, from the minute they step foot through the door, to always have a forward-moving journey, because recovery is about moving forward. And we recognize individuals may come back, but we're going to set them on the right path. One of the distinct features, and there are several distinct features about the Crisis Center, all of which can be seen with video that we have on our website. But what's very interesting is the discharge lobby and the entrance lobby, they are separate. So when you come in crisis, we recognize there is a certain state that you may present in. We don't want you to leave in that same way. We don't want you to be triggered by something that's happening in the lobby. We want to set you out on your journey with support, wraparound services, medications in hand. There is an on-site pharmacy as well, to get you on the best path forward. The other thing, and Susan, I think, mentioned it, is our goal is not to have you leave the facility with a flyer or a brochure. We want that relationship to happen, that intentional relationship with a community-based provider to happen while you are in the center. And so we You know, we took a stand, we made a decision, and we said we are going to build space for other community-based partners to take up residence in that crisis center on the second floor so that they are always close to the patients they serve. And so they're always welcome. They have secure workspace and a secure, you know, secure digital environment that they're able to connect with the resources at their home agency and yet build relationships with the people in the facility. Now, what I just said doesn't do it justice. The photography is beautiful. The experience is different. And the experts in the back of the room, so make sure you see them if you have different questions.
Do we have any other questions, Doug?
Very briefly, we just have about 1 minute left, but Henry Shore asks, what remaining gaps in crisis care have we identified and which one is, should be the priority?
I think, I think that our response that's needed in the community is ever-changing because issues that people are experiencing in our community are ever-changing. I think there's, you know, we talk about crisis a lot in terms of mental health and substance use disorder. We are also in the midst of a housing crisis that most certainly is incredibly disruptive to people. So figuring out how we can integrate in other different types of crisis intervention to address different types of needs and have a system that is flexible and able to evolve as the needs in our community are changing and evolving is going to be important. And I think to the points I made earlier, my number one concern is scale, figuring out how to invest and shore up, you know, to organizations like NetCare that have been doing this work for 50 years have done it this whole time at a loss, at a financial loss, and figured out how to make it work and how to make up the difference, because this work matters because they're mission-driven organizations. And so figuring out how do we shore up our existing infrastructure now, as we know there's going to be cuts that are going to affect existing services today and our capacity we have today, and how do we generate resources so that we can scale them to continue growing and meet needs in the future.
I do agree. I know we have to wrap up. I agree funding is a challenge, but I would say this. Data, right? We are collecting data now. We want to be able to make data-informed decisions about how we allocate our resources in the future. When we attract these resources, we want to make sure we're allocating them appropriately. Our data suggests there are between 350 and 400 crisis interactions per day in our community. That is spread over calls to 988, 911, dispatching of mobile crisis response, or individuals showing up at a facility-based crisis care center. So we have work to do. We don't want that type of volume. We also know that 80% of the calls are coming in at 911 versus 20% at 988 in our community-based crisis lines. We want to flip that. We want the majority of behavioral health calls to come in the most appropriate places.
I can't tell if that's stop or hurry up. Okay, don't talk.
I just want to say that I think an alternate crisis response that doesn't involve officers is what's missing. Thank you.
Thank you. I will now turn it over to our presiding officer, Tony.
You've been listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. This week, we explored how Central Ohio is transforming crisis response from the 988 hotline to new facilities and community-led safety programs. We're grateful to this week's panelists, Melissa Green, Columbus City Council member, Erica Clark-Jones with the Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board of Franklin County, Dr. Brian Stroh with NetCare, Chana Wiley with the Columbus Collective Safety Campaign, and our host, Samantha Hendrickson with the Columbus Dispatch. The presenting sponsors of CMC's Optimal Health Series are Ohio Health, Nationwide Children's Hospital, and the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. This forum was supported by the Jeffrey Family Legacy and Civic Engagement Fund and sponsored by the Osteopathic Heritage Foundation, Cardinal Health, the Community Shelter Board, Ian Alexander Photography, and Star House. The presenting sponsor of our live stream was the Center for Human Kindness at the Columbus Foundation. Our live stream and promotional partner was the Columbus Dispatch. This forum was also supported by the Ellis. If you or someone you know is in crisis, you can call or text 988 to connect with the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Join us next week as the not-for-profit Columbus Metropolitan Club once again connects people and ideas through community conversations. I'm Doug Buchanan with CMC. Thanks for listening.